Well met, and welcome to episode 71, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for February 20th, 2011. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we continue our month-long discussion of Henry V, with a discussion of the productions available for viewing on DVD and online. Then we finish up with our usual recap of this week's blog entries. As we usually do, we start our DVD reviews with the BBC Complete Works series, as they are relentlessly straightforward with no, or at least very little, directorial concept. They also incorporate very few line edits. And as we've noted in the past, there's a bit of trivia concerning the directing of the history plays in the series. When the overall series was being planned, the idea was that David Giles would direct all of the histories in the two tetralogies from Richard II through Richard III, employing the same actors in their roles across plays. But when scheduling issues arose with actors, that plan was scrapped, and the second chronological tetralogy, which we watched in late 2009 and January of 2010, was given to Jane Howell to direct. However, Giles still got to direct this tetralogy, Richard II through Henry V. From the second season, this production was taped in 1979, then broadcast in the U.S. in 1980. Even though Giles had directed the previous plays, unlike the last two plays, he does nothing to connect this play to what came before. The production begins with a black screen and the chorus walking in from the side. As he speaks, the lighting comes up, revealing the two sides of the war. David Gwillem's Henry begins a solemn, listening monarch. He comes into the questioning of the clergy seemingly without an agenda. He's even measured when he receives the insulting gift from the Dauphin. Only on the messenger's exit does Henry let the mask drop. Then he's relaxed, funny, even tossing the balls to the other nobles. When we meet Ken Drinkle as the Dauphin, he is Henry's visual doppelganger, a perfect visual foil, effeminate versus swaggering, foppish versus a man's man. His father, King Charles, is a strong monarch here, against other weaker or even unstable portrayals, and against my own personal reading. But Charles's strength is nothing compared to Henry's. Even as he tries to get the troops to go once more into the breach, he's smiling, joking, and then grows it into a stirring speech. Henry etches his ceremony soliloquy later in the play with sarcasm to start, but slowly moving into bemusement. It's a long speech, one long enough for Henry to move into the emotions of sadness, then sincerity as he prays to God. His St. Crispin Day speech begins not as a speech of a rabble-rouser, but as an idealistic jokester. His wooing of Catherine is charming and funny. It's a strong performance. Director Giles fills the production with other nice little touches as well. The whispered dialogue between Exeter and the Dauphin. The hesitation of Pistol when he's leading off his prisoner and then hearing explosions. The casual cruelty of Henry and his tossed-off kill-the-prisoners line, the brutal beating of Pistol, and a cute, but not nearly bawdy as it could have been, English lesson. Led by Gwillem's Henry and Giles's direction, this is a solid production, and the perfect way to kick off this discussion. Okay, so that was the late 70s BBC Collected Works production. Let's transition back to the 1960 BBC Shakespeare's An Age of Kings sequence of history plays. Like nearly all the plays, Henry V is broken into two episodes, Signs of War and The Band of Brothers, both directed by the director of the entire series, Michael Hayes. Remember, this is from the old days, and the look and feel is like a black and white Twilight Zone, stagey and a little fuzzy round the edges. The first hour, Signs of War, begins with the opening chorus, which takes us on to a television stage. It skips Act 1, Scene 1, and gets us to King Henry as quickly as possible. It's a good choice, as Robert Hardy's King is the best thing about these episodes. When he responds to the tennis balls, he is the only Henry thus far to raise his voice. And for a moment it feels overdone, but it kicks the play into gear and the effect is electric. Even the chorus is excited when we next see him. As he speaks of the conspiracy, we see a tableau of the conspirators in the background. It's a nice touch. Director Hayes also does some nice stuff with the camera as well. At the end of Act 2, Scene 2, Henry ascends the scaffolding at Southampton, and the camera cranes up with him. It's a big, bold movement and perfect for his heading off to war. Later, when Henry is urging his soldiers to go once more into the breach, Hayes puts the camera near the back of the pack of warriors so that Henry speaks to all of us. We're the yeomen. And later still, when Henry gives his ultimatum to the governor of Harfleur, We're up on the battlements, so again, we see the action from the governor's point of view. What's surprising, for me at least, is that for 1960s television, the English lesson scene with Catherine comes closer to being bawdy than the version from 20 years later, or Olivier's nearly 20 years earlier. The Catherine, an incredibly young, just 26, and cute Judi Dench, actually looks scandalized when we get to the foot and gown punchline of the scene. It's fun. The hour builds to a strong ending. From Henry's silent reaction to Fluellen's mention of Bardolph's crime, to his casual disregard of Montjoy's call for ransom, which elicits English laughter, to Henry's ultimate swagger, bragging thus, it's just a great scene, and a wonderful juxtaposition to the final scene with the French fops. It's nicely done. The second hour, the band of brothers, kicks off with the chorus coming up out of the English camp. We skip Pistol and Fluellen and get directly to Williams and Bates. Hardy's soliloquies, both the ceremony speech and the prayer to the God of Battles, are solid, but the next morning's big St. Crispin's Day speech is almost too big. There's definitely too many pauses, a little too Shatner for me. Because we actually see the killing of the boys, as opposed to just hear the results, we completely understand Henry's brutal call for the killing of the prisoners. The only thing that stops the slaughter is the arrival of Montjoy to call off the battle. The centerpiece of the second hour is the wooing of Kate, again the young and cute Dame Dench. It's a great scene, beginning with Henry's clumsy physical presence too close to the princess. He tries to make jokes, but she doesn't get them, and that makes the scene even funnier. Or does she not get the jokes? She certainly toys with him, me understand well. And he catches her playing with him, and all of this makes the scene charming and wonderful. And at this point, Hardy's my favorite Henry. And so it's sad that the final image of the hour, over William Squire's final chorus, is that of Henry's coffin. Overall, this is a very solid production. Let's go back in time a decade and a half for the version by that consensus master of the cinematic Shakespeare, Laurence Olivier. His The Chronicle History of King Henry V with his battle fought at Agincourt in France was made in 1944 as a piece of morale-boosting propaganda during World War II. And stylistically, it's a masterpiece. It begins with a floating piece of paper that comes into focus and takes us back to the Globe Theater in 1600. There, we're in the audience for a performance of Henry V, and the chorus is full of declarations. Act 1, Scene 1 is played above and comically to the crowd, much to their delight. And here Olivier the Adapter begins playing with the text, adding some lines from the second part of Henry IV to introduce the concept of Hal turning his back on Falstaff. Between scenes, we even get to see what's going on backstage at the Globe. When Henry makes his appearance on stage, Olivier is in pure declamatory style, and it works within the context of the Globe setting. As time goes by, however, and we get to Southampton, we get to what is more like an elaborate set, but still not realistic. Then, when we get back to the tavern, the setting has become more real, a movie set, and here we actually see Falstaff's death. Olivier's Frenchmen are ridiculously effeminate, and their King Charles VI is crazy, which is not as extreme as it sounds, as there's some historical truth to it. The English lesson is almost completely chaste. While the French language might have been risque, it certainly is performed in a way to not make that clear to an English audience. Olivier, the director, by beginning the play at the Globe, sets up for a rather flat, no pun intended, kickoff. But when we get to the war, he begins to open up the style, and we get a heroic camera move for the Unto the Breach scene. And by the time we get to the night before the battle, the movie has hit its rhythm. The St. Crispin's Day speech starts just to Westmoreland, but then grows to the entire army, again culminating in a grand camera movement at the end of the scene. And I'm pretty sure Kenneth Branagh lifted this sequence pretty much shot for shot. I'm going to need to keep that in mind later. Olivier's Henry is purely heroic. There is no hanging of Bardolph, no refusal of pardoning him, and certainly no killing of prisoners. After the dastardly killing of the boys, Henry performs single combat with the Constable of France, which is nowhere in the play. He is an unadulterated hero. His wooing of Catherine is straightforward, not cute or even charming, really. We get to see the wedding, and the applause of the court takes us back to the clapping of the audience of the Globe Theater, and we've come full circle. Then the chorus's epilogue cuts, the ominous foreshadowing of his death and the loss of France, which is fitting as, remember, this was supposed to be pro-English propaganda, and that just wouldn't fit here. less pro-British propaganda and more comment on the mid-80s Falkland Island War is Kenneth Branagh's 1989 version. This is Branagh pulling in Olivier, directing, adapting, and starring. This is a more straightforward and less stylized version, even though Derek Jacobi's chorus does open the production in a movie set. Now, I remember seeing this film when it opened, and I was still in my first years in the classroom. I loved this film. This, and Dead Again and Much Ado, made me a Branagh fan big time. Don't get me wrong, I still like this film, but watching it last among all this week's productions, it's just not as great as I remember. What I find now is the bigness and physicality of Branagh's Henry and the slimness of the script. Because he cuts so much. From the little things like the discussion of the Scottish Rebellion to bigger things, mostly later in the play, gone is almost all of the boy stuff, even though that boy was played by an incredibly young Christian Bale. Yep, the boy was played by the Dark Knight. Gone is much of the pistol stuff. Gone is the French prisoner. Gone is the post-battle Henry Williams Fluellen fight, replaced by a nice little silent handing of the glove by Henry to Williams. And gone is all the Fluellen pistol eating the leek stuff. It's not a short film, though, even though it feels like it. So what gets put in? Extended flashbacks to Falstaff, played by Robbie Coltrane, using snippets from the two Henry IV plays, and with Mistress Quickly, played by, you got it, Dame Dench, much older here. Plus, we get a long battle sequence. And this Battle of Agincourt is not an easy victory. And it isn't clean. And it is brutal. This is not your father's Olivier. Branagh nails all the big speeches. Once More Into the Breach? Fantastic. It begins with the cry out of those first two lines and then being blown back by an explosion, forcing Henry to have to go and convince the troops to follow him back. It's just great. The ceremony soliloquy is well done, perfectly set as he's surrounded by sleeping troops looking like so many corpses on the ground. And finally, St. Crispin's Day is before the entire army. And yes, he steals that cart thing from Olivier. But of all the versions I've seen, this is the most rousing, the most stirring, in my opinion. And I'm even getting a little goose flesh thinking about it. Of note in this one is the wooing sequence with Branagh and his wife-to-be at the time, Emma Thompson. She's harsh, forcing him to regroup. He spins it as many ways as he can, and finally, his charm wins her over. It's a fun sequence, capping a very strong movie. Now let's finish up with the Henry V section of the English Shakespeare Company's production of The War of the Roses, directed by Michael Bogdanov. It was done back in 1990, and I found it on YouTube. Like all the plays in the cycle, it's a modernistic take on the plays, and this one uses costuming from the 40s through the 80s. And building on the not-quite-heroic Henry of the second part of Henry IV, Michael Pennington is measured, relatively humorless as our title character. Director Bogdanov splits the Act II chorus so that when he discusses dread preparation coming after the tavern, it's an ironically comic line. He also changes the order of the speeches in the traitor sequence so that the nobles' fear of trusting the traitors comes after they've already begun to speak to Henry. After they try to escape, one is cut down by sniper fire from above, and Henry lays on the guilt thick. And only in sentencing them to death does Henry begin to seem strong in any way. Before we get to the war, however, Bogdanov gives us welcome comedy back at the tavern. The silhouette of them bearing, straining under the weight of Falstaff's coffin is funny. And since June Watson's Quickly is more moving than I've found in most of the other versions, the comedy that follows, their remembrances of Falstaff, their goodbyes, the use of my way under their goodbyes, becomes even funnier. Unlike the foppish dauphins we've seen in the other versions, here, our Richard III from the series, Andrew Jarvis, plays a French prince who is more of a hothead full of bravado, seemingly out of place in the pastoral picnic of the French court, complete with queen and princess sitting on a blanket. When Exeter arrives, he walks right over and through that blanket. Not all of the directorial choices pay off, though. The Once More Into the Breach speech is spoken in smoke and chaos, with a sense of desperation in his voice. It feels long and almost boring, even as he tries to make a connection with his soldiers in the second half of the speech. Better is the following scene with the governor of Harfleur, quiet and intense at a negotiation table. When the town is surrendered, Henry looks relieved to the point of gratitude. It's obvious that he would not have had the stomach to follow through on his threats. The English lesson introduces us to Catherine, but here she is petulant, and when we get to the body nest, she's more shocked than amused. While it's interesting, that doesn't mean that it works completely. At the center of the play, of course, is Henry, and Pennington is a mixed bag. From the start, I think he's at a disadvantage because he looks too old for the role, but that age works to his advantage in the ceremony soliloquy, showing his maturity. As I've noted before, I found the breech speech rambling, and as if trying to overcompensate, his St. Crispin Day's speech, spoken only to the nobles, not to the army at large, is rushed. It's as if battle changes Henry, turning him desperate, which might account for his screamed, "Kill the prisoners," which leads us to see Pistol doing just that. And yet, as if not to tip the balance too much to the negative, Bogdanoff cuts Fluellen's reference to Alexander the Pig's killing of his best friend, and by extension, Hal's handling of Falstaff. A different approach is taken in the wooing scene. Catherine arrives in black-veiled mourning. Henry begins the scene resigned to the political aspect of the marriage, almost bored in the wooing. This is a purely political endeavor, and it is only when Henry attempts to speak French does any emotion rise in the scene. But it's still political, as his emphasis on "I love thee cruelly" and "soldier breeder" attests. And while this may make it seem that I didn't enjoy the production, that's not the case fully. There are some great touches in the play. The French watch a slideshow of the British in war as they discuss the invasion. Henry watches as Bardolph is taken off to his execution. Henry pays the herald Montjoy for his pains with a tennis ball. It's a solid and interesting, if not completely successful, production. So where do I stand on all these? The Complete Works DVD is a must, powered by a strong lead in David Gwillim. The Age of Kings DVD is worth a viewing as well, again fueled by a strong performance by Robert Hardy and a cute and young Judi Dench. The Olivier is probably required viewing, as it's seen by many as a classic, though, quite frankly, it's at the bottom of these productions, in my opinion. The Branna is strong, but not nearly as cool as I remember it, but I still like it. And The War of the Roses, it's good for contrast, but is not required viewing. All but The War of the Roses are available on DVD, and all of those, save Age of Kings, is available at Netflix. And War of the Roses can be found on the Bill Shakespeare Project YouTube page, and I'll make sure I put a link to that at the end of this blog entry. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including historical timeline, historical inaccuracies, sorry, Henry's greatest hits once more, Henry's greatest hits The Siege of Harfleur, and Henry's greatest hits St. Crispin's Day. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page. Remember that the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news and notes than the daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for February 20th, 2011. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.